Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hope everybody's doing well today. I want to welcome everybody to the Unimpressed Podcast. And today I have a friend calling in from New York City. His name is Charles Bush. He's been on Broadway for a long, long time. Welcome, Charles. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. Wonderful to see you.
We were talking about creativity, and when you started this journey out, did you think you would be where you're at now with the creativity that's been in your career?
All my life, my earliest memories, I was involved in some sort of creative mode, you know, drawing or wanting to perform or writing. It was always such a huge part of my life that there was no question that I would just continue doing this and that I would find a way to make that focus of my entire life.
Where were you born and what's your family like and what's your lineage?
I'm about as much a New Yorker as anyone can be. I was born here in New York City, lived here all my life, except for the brief period when I went to college. I went to Northwestern University in Illinois, and then I lived in Chicago for about 2 years after I graduated, but then came back here and can't get out. I've just always been here, and it seemed the right place for someone who wanted a career in the theater, and then my family being here. And I guess the first big event of my life was that my mother died when I was 7 years old. And that seems to have been every person I know who lost a parent at an early age, like it sort of marks them. And I think that was a key event. Everything I've done since then, I can see some sort of connection to that.
You've seen a lot, obviously, if you lived in New York City. When I lived up there, I knew a couple writers trying to get on Broadway. It's a very, very tough industry. The toughest, I would think, in entertainment.
I've been very, very fortunate. Well, for one thing, you know, I'd always wanted to be in theater. Somehow, I was always writing, although the focus when I was very young was the idea was to be an actor. And then I was taken to Broadway. I was really raised by my aunt, my mother's older sister. My aunt Lillian was a huge influence in my life. And she started taking me to the theater at 8 years old. And then when I got to Northwestern and I was in the theater department there, and I was never cast in a play, and it just seemed that you know, I was just not right. I was this rather androgynous young kid. And the thing was that there in those days, in the early 70s, there were no roles written for, you know, a gay kid. You know, we didn't have Angels in America or Torch on Trilogy or all these plays. And so I couldn't really fit myself into any other kind of role. So I was never cast. And then I thought there really weren't any roles I was desperate to play, and I began, and since I always was writing, then I thought, well, if I'm going to have a career, I'll have to write roles for myself. And that's, I have a pretty pragmatic mind. And so I thought that this is the path that I'll take. And so I started, you know, and I felt that, I'm sort of skipping ahead. I had seen the work of a very fascinating writer, performer, director named Charles Ludlam, who was very influential, and I went to see his theater company that he had, where had elements of classic film in his plays and opera. There were men playing female characters, and all that so resonated with me, and he was a big influence. So and I saw that what made me kind of seem unemployable was could actually be what is my path.
How many no's did you get trying to get your first break?
Almost none, to be quite honest. I mean, I had 10 years of being, my first career was as a solo performer, where I would, I did these pieces where I played all the different characters in the story, and I didn't change costume. I would just change, you know, voices, and they were these rather elaborate narratives. And that was very difficult. And I never had management. So I booked myself at small nonprofit theaters around the country, and that was really my apprenticeship for about 10 years. So yeah, so there were a number of no's there, but I was still kind of in charge of my own destiny. You know, I would just try to book myself at these different theaters around the country. And so, and I got some validation that I wasn't deranged, that this is the right road to take. And then I just by chance, my life has really been ruled by chance and kind of creating my own luck in a sense by putting myself in situations where luck might find me. So in 1984, after about 10 years of doing this, and I guess I was 30, I put on a little play just for the fun of it. It was about 40 minutes long at a after hours bar / art gallery in a very funky part of New York, in the East Village called Alphabet City. That was kind of the area where Madonna and the artist Keith Haring came out of that period in the 80s. And it was a hot place to be. So when I wrote this play, Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, just as a kind of a sketch to do for two nights in this bar. And I got all my different friends of mine that I knew from different parts of my life together, had them in this little play. And it took off. I was in the right place at the right time. And it just took off. And we produced the show ourselves at a regular theater off Broadway. And it became a big hit and ran for 5 years. And that really established me overnight success after 11 years as a writer performer. And so I really, my career mostly has really been off Broadway. And I didn't, as far as Broadway goes, I was content with the career that I had. You know, it's perfectly fine. I supported myself. So I wasn't always thinking, though, the big dream is to be on Broadway. That was not. But then circumstances happened where I was asked to write the book to a musical that was going to be produced by a nonprofit theater called Manhattan Theater Club, which is one of the main nonprofit theaters here in the United States, I'd say. And I wrote the book to this musical, which was not particularly well received. I established a very good relationship with Lynn Meadow, who's the artistic director of this important nonprofit theater. And so she said, when the fairly negative reviews of this musical came out, she said to me, I'd like to produce your next play, whatever it is. So I wrote a play that I thought would be suitable for her theater, which was rather, you know, very, I don't know, what would you want to say it, a traditional kind of type theater. Yeah, subscriber theater, you know, with an older audience, a well-heeled audience. My plays up till then really had been these Hollywood pastiche homages to old movies with myself, you know, in the female lead and drag. I thought, well, I should, that's not, you know, going to go over at Manhattan Theater Club. So I wrote a more conventional play called The Tale of the Allergist's Wife about a New York family. This woman, Marjorie Taub, who's this culturally striving, very, very frustrated middle-aged woman. And Lynn really liked the play. And so we got a wonderful cast, Linda Lavin and Michelle Lee and Tony Roberts. And it opened at Manhattan Theater Club and they got great reviews. And then it was decided to move it to Broadway shortly after it opened at the Barrymore Theater and was, you know, a big success. And longest running comedy on Broadway, 28 years or something like that. And it was, but I tell this long story and just that it was not my goal. So I didn't have a lot of doors slammed in my face because I didn't put myself in that situation. You know, as a writer, actor, I had my own company. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, raised the money ourselves to be off Broadway. And then, you know, once that was established, I was able to write new plays at various nonprofit theaters. And then we would transfer them off Broadway, you know, for commercial run. And so I've been very fortunate that way. And I feel like I did pay my dues for those first 11 years. Once Vampire Lesbians of Sodom established me, it's I've done what I've wanted to do.
A couple things stand out to me. Controlling your own narrative and staying authentic to yourself. Coming up in the time you came up, being gay, did you think there was more of a pure source and direction and not letting these exterior things bother you during your career?
It's funny, I keep using the same word, fortunate. One thing, I'm first generation post-Stonewall. I didn't know, and I grew up in New York City, see, in a very liberal environment. So I wasn't really exposed to terrible prejudice against gay people or know, I didn't have a strict religious background that could provide all sorts of complications. And I had a supportive family. I'm a lucky fella. You know, the big event of my youth, of course, was the AIDS crisis, which in a way was how some of our parents think of World War II. For my generation of gay person, that was our war, you know, mm-hmm. that we went through for those years, and we suffered so many losses, and you know, key members of my theater company died of AIDS, and so many people I knew, and that was really the a huge part of my experience. But I never had coming out gay was sort of a non-event. I never came out because everybody, I guess, assumed. You know? And the choices I've made. I have to say one thing. It's so funny. I'm coming off like, oh boy, people think, well, he sure has had an easy time of it. But one thing I was raised in a great way is that it was just not part of my thinking. What will people think? Part of my personality. I guess I wasn't raised that way. Or I think it's really just me, frankly. I think it's just in my head. So, you know, when people ask me, that was very brave of you to perform it, you know, to start performing in drag. So brave. It didn't occur to me as being brave. I thought it was just fun to do. I love these old movie actresses and I'm able to somehow embody them, that naturally this is what I'll do. It didn't occur to me like, oh gosh, do I dare? What will people think? You know, I've been free of that.
I think there's a lesson to learn there, because I always have this saying. I think right now society feeds off what they see. When you feed off what you see, you continue to create opinions and controversy. But if you create your own environment with a new idea, you eliminate those opinions and controversy because you are sure of yourself. And I think some people let these stereotypes affect their lives. And they really don't have to if they stay pure with themselves. I think in a way, you said you're lucky. Maybe it's a pattern more people should follow and be authentic to themselves.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think there are lessons people could glean from my experience. Don't be so concerned what people will think. Try to have faith in your own eccentricity, whatever it is about you that maybe disturbs people. Perhaps that's who you really are. Cultivate it.
People don't realize, too, by law of attraction, if you're an authentic, pure source, I think you will be successful. And by law of attraction, you attract the right people without trying.
Yes, I was. One thing I think was great was that when I started, particularly when we started our theater company, all the people were we attracted a talented group of people. We sought them out, you know, the friends that my roommate, Ken Elliott, directed our company and really produced and directed. And I was in a way that I couldn't have done. And Ken was was very talented and also just very no nonsense and direct and knew how to put on a show and get things done. So one good thing that's happened to me, and it started off with my aunt when I was, you know, who adopted me, was that there's always been somebody in my life that has great energy and great powers of concentration. You know, I and it seems that, and they're attracted to my very fertile imagination, and I've been helped each step of the way with a sequence of people who just have great focus and have somehow been attracted to me and wanted to help me and got great satisfaction out of doing that.
I think it's very hard to find a true talent, first of all, and you got to have the right people around you to recognize that. Talk about departmentalizing your mind. This gay sensibility doing drag, how are we going to put these pieces together that's going to make a great show? That's a tremendous talent. What goes through your head putting all these pieces together and departmentalizing a show from your perspective? To put on a show or write a play, whatever that is, from your thought process.
Like a dream.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That you just somehow need to make real. You know, often a lot of the parts I wrote for myself, those plays would come about with a bit of a just me thinking, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to be a character like out of in a 1940s anti-Nazi war melodrama. I'd like to play this very brittle, glamorous American concert pianist, and she somehow gets mixed up with she's touring Bavaria in 1940 and gets mixed up in a plot to rescue a anti-Nazi actress, you know, from a Nazi prison. And, you know, I'd love to play that kind of part. And then my talent is that I can actually put it on paper. And then my other talent is the gift I had was that I have these friends that I think are very talented and I write roles for them. Oh, wouldn't it be fun I'd like to have Julie should play my sidekick who I knew back in our vaudeville days and now she's a countess and that'd be a good part for Julie. And oh, and Arnie, he could play the young American who's enlists me in this wild plan. And Ken could be the Nazi Baron. Oh, and he'd be funny in that part. And then it all happens and then we do it.
You may be a clairsentient as well, feeling that, understanding that for yourself.
I wouldn't be surprised. I have many feelings like that. I know I don't really discuss it or anything, but sometimes I really do feel like I was reincarnated from somebody in an earlier time because by the time I was 9 years old, I was drawing these cross sections of a bordello with all the different prostitutes hanging around. I know I'd seen movies, but I don't know if I'd really seen the paintings of Toulouse-Lautrec yet. And I don't know. And then I just felt such an affinity for when I would read as a young kid, look these picture books of stars of the 19th century, stage stars from the 19th century, and just feel such a kinship or just fascinated.
I think that's a feel to be able to recognize character if you know yourself and the ability to be able to feel that and be able to find this feeling of a character. A feeling with this character here with certain sensibilities and a feeling with this character here with certain sensibilities. A lot of people can't do that. I think that's a very limited individual.
Well, I think the other thing is I've noticed that, and this helped me with this memoir that I just finished. I post a lot on Facebook, and my book really was helped by my Facebook posts. And I've just the most marvelous, you know, Facebook friends who have been so encouraging. And I would write a chapter and then edit it down and post it on Facebook and see what the reaction was. And often people comment that, oh, you have so many stories and your life is so fascinating. And I don't know, I kind of think everybody's life is really interesting, but I do have a gift for narrative. All my life, I think while I'm in the experience, I'm already shaping it as an anecdote. Oh. And often I would throw myself into experiences knowing that it's going to be a good story.
I was just going to say the name of the book is Leading Lady, a memoir of an unusual boy. What should we expect from the book? I know we walked through a few things about your career.
A hopefully inspiring story about somebody who didn't seem the obvious choice to have a full career, you know, in show business and made it happen for himself, built the door and walked through it.
A lot of people are scared to do that.
I really have had a rather unique career in that I've been embraced by the drag world, but also the theater world. And so, and they come together in the oddest ways. I mean, I'm sometimes, because I played so many female roles, sometimes I'm just accepted as an actress. One of the big events every year they have, through Broadway, the group Broadway Cares, is they have this thing called, I don't know what it's called, they keep changing the names, but it used to be called Gypsy of the Year, and now it's called, I think, Red Ribbon something, I don't know. They've changed because the word gypsy isn't cool anymore. So anyway, and a lot of famous people are, you know, on the bill. And so one year I arrived and they took me to a group dressing room at the theater. And I was the first to get there and I'm unpacking my stuff. I was with my friend Carl and get my stuff. And then in walks Carol Burnett and Carol Channing and Betty Buckley and all these famous actresses. And I thought, am I in the right room? And they, you know, they just put me in with all the ladies. And that was kind of amusing. Somebody just took me at face value. In a way, I made a certain choice to not be in show business, because when I've actually done things, or, you know, I wrote the book to the book to this musical called Taboo that Rosie O'Donnell produced on Broadway. It was, the music was by Boy George, and that was real showbiz, and I was really miserable doing that. And then there were a number of years where I sold all these different, I pitched and sold different TV pilots to CBS and HBO and Showtime, and I had since I didn't really care, I wasn't nervous at all. So I would just go in and see these different vice presidents and act out this idea for a sitcom. And I had 100% track record that they bought each one, but I don't think I was very good at it. Cause when I would then write the actual pilot, after they paid me, it was okay. And nothing was ever shot. I never had even a pilot made, let alone a show on the air. But I just didn't like it. I got a kick out of the idea that I could fool them and get the deal, but it was not a world that I enjoyed. And I just preferred, you know, I earned my very nice living having my theater company and doing my plays, you know, off Broadway. And actually, when I had my one big Broadway hit, The Allergist's Wife, that really wasn't so show busy. You know, it all kind of came about through, you know, sort of Lynn Meadow at Manhattan Theater Club really, you know, being fond of me and liking what I did. And, you know, it wasn't a big ordeal. And there were all sorts of people interfering and demanding rewrites. And, you know, I didn't have to compromise to try to please a bunch of vice presidents. No game had to be played. And that's what I tend to associate with show business, that there are all sorts of people having to justify their employment. Yes, and you've got to play this game of, okay, well, I'll give in to that dumb idea because it's not too destructive. And that way, maybe if I give in to that, I can hold on to the more important one idea. What's that about? So I just gradually, I kind of removed myself from what I call show business and just stayed in the theater. And even I've made a series of movies over the years, indie films. Psycho Beach Party, Die Mommy Die. I have a new movie that we're hoping will be released soon called The Sixth Reel. And even those movies were not really show busy. They weren't, you know, big corporate affairs. They were small films that, for the most part, nobody interfered with us. They just, you know, I don't want to give this person's name, but I recently was talking to the legendary lady who's had, you know, just extraordinary career for decades and decades, and I think we were chatting and I could tell by the silence on the other line that she thought I was just from a whole different planet.
If executive realized they have a great talent and has this pure source narrative, if that narrative comes out from a pure source, and I go back to law of attraction, it's going to be exponential. And I understand what you're saying. I think studios need to recognize that, reverse engineer the process, give a talent an outline, let the creative be who they are. When you get in that commercial space, you get 20 people in the room to dilute the process.
Right. I suspect what goes on when we do see shows on television that are really original, I suspect that producer writer has paid their dues, you know, mm-hmm. And have finally gotten to a position where for the most part, they're left alone. How you get, like, you know, White Lotus or some of these shows. I don't really watch a lot of this TV, but from what I here. A lot of shows that are very interesting and have a very idiosyncratic point of view, that person paid a lot of dues until they got powerful enough to just have their vision. But I was never willing to pay the dues. I've had a good life. That's all I care about. People who love me and, you know, close to me and I earn my living, you know, just I've had a good life. I hope that's conveyed in my book, Amazon, wherever fine books are sold. That is kind of the, you know, I'm not the most famous person. I've got a strange kind of fame that to the majority of the public, I'm totally unknown. And yet to a rather small coterie, I'm loved intensely.
You're like the original drag queen. I think it's something I read.
I'm sort of the godmother of drag. You know, I'm kind of embraced by this drag community, if there is one, but I've never lip synced a song or performed in a club. My drag has been solely performing different series of characters in my plays and movies. You know, I don't have a one persona, like a, you know, with a name, you know. I play a different character in every play, but in a way, what I've found, been discovering, that a number of these famous RuPaul Drag Race queens, the first time they were ever in drag were in local productions of my plays around the country. I have a new play that we're going to do next winter. It's a joint production between two theaters, this very lovely theater in New Brunswick called the George Street Playhouse. We do it there for a few weeks, and then we move it nonprofit in New York called Primary Stages Theater Company. So I'm a little nervous about it. It's a very big part I've written for myself, and it'll be a number of years since I've done a play. And so I've been memorizing lines. I started memorizing lines 4 months ago, but I'm going to show up that first day perfect.
What's your daily life like? Just normal things you do?
Been so much time, too much time, because it's not good for me. Too much time sitting here at this computer writing. I think just the I really have discovered that I think my favorite thing ever to do, and I just can go on for hours and hours, is when I've written something and it's already basically done. I can just spend hours going in and changing one word, then changing it back, putting it back in, changing it. And I just find it endlessly fascinating. You know, I live in the most beautiful neighborhood. You know, I live here in Greenwich Village. You know, it's an area, Abingdon Square, and it's almost like you're living in Paris. It's so beautiful. And I've lived here really almost my whole life. When I was a kid, when I was in high school, I would come down to this area and walk around and dream that someday I'll live here. And then my first apartment was around the corner in a real beautiful street, and like the one crummy building. And I lived there for a while. And then I was able to after about 15 years, move into a much nicer building where I am now. And so I really only lived in, basically, except for when I went to college, which I don't really count, I've only lived in three different apartments my entire life. Yeah, so I mean, I love this neighborhood, and I lead a rather quiet kind of life. But I've been going out more often now. I'm trying to just, you know, to say yes to everything. I can easily slip into a kind of reclusive Miss Havisham kind of way, but I'm fighting that inclination. And basically, anybody who says, "Oh, you want to go out to dinner next week?" Yep, I'll go there.
I can go hide in a room and not have anybody around and work and feel great. But if I'm around multiple energies or whatever, sometimes that throws me off. So I can definitely understand being a reclusive.
I can be both the life of the party, and I can also be very kind of inward, shut down kind of person too. I never know which one's going to pop up. But I, you know, I am a performer, so usually if I'm in a group, you know, I perk up and try to be the best Charles Bush I can be. But nice. But I've all my life, I'm one of the world's great self-amusers. I can spend a lot of time and not feel lonely. Occasionally, once in a while, I feel pangs of loneliness. But for the most part, yeah, I just, there's always something to draw or to write or to, I don't know, dream.
I think more people need to take that advice, and more people would be happier. And if they didn't let the outside influences affect you and be true to yourself. Well, I definitely think people can learn something from you. And this has been the great Charles Bush. And my name's John Edmonds Cosma, the CEO of Bain Productions.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.